was Tango to Evora by Lorena McKennett, one of my favorite pieces of hers. She's blessed with the voice of an angel, and she uses it well. And good morning, my friends. It's going to be a beautiful Friday morning out there in Cascadia, so if you're still lying in bed, time to rub your eyes and throw over the covers and wake up and join the day. This is Melody Silverwolf, and I'm here with Positively Revolting Talk Radio until 9 o'clock this morning. My lovely co-host, Ani Haynes, is communing with nature at the ocean shore today, so she will not be here. She'll be back next week, and I'm going to be joined by Chris Andre today, the lovely Chris Andre of KBOO Morning News fame, who you just heard sharing the day's events with you, and she's going to be helping me to interview our very special guest, Milan Rye, today. And we'll be talking with Milan in just a moment. Milan is the author of 7-7, The London Bombings, Islam, and the Iraq War. That's actually his third or fourth book. And he's currently on a tour of the United States promoting this book and discussing his work in the UK. And we're going to be interviewing him about his book and his travels. And he's going to be appearing at Laughing Horse Books on Wednesday, the 21st. At 7. Now, Laughing Horse, for those of you who may not know, has recently moved. And instead of on Division, they now are located on at 12 Northeast 10th Avenue. That's just off of Burnside in Portland. So they're basically walking distance from KBOO. They're just two streets up, and like up just a short walk up Burnside, a few doors, and there they are. So that's going to be Wednesday the 21st at 7, and this event's being co-sponsored by the Peace and Justice Works Iraq Affinity Group, my favorite guy, Dan Handelman, who coordinates that. So if you need more information about Milan Rye's visit, you can go to iraq@pjw.info, or you can call 503-236-3065. Now, let me tell you a little bit about Milan Rye. As I said, he's the author of 7-7, The London Bombings, Islam and the Iraq War. And he's a peace activist, and he also is the author of Chomsky's Politics, War Plan Iraq, 10 Reasons Why We Shouldn't Launch Another War on Iraq, and Regime Unchanged. And he's co-founded the Direct Action and Information Group, ARRO, which stands for Active Resistance to the Roots of War. In 1990, it's the British branch of Voices, the British branch of Voices in the Wilderness in 1998, and a group called Justice Not Vengeance in the aftermath of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. And he's been on 4 sanctions-breaking delegations to Iraq, as did Mr. Handelman, of course. And Milan traveled to Iraq between 1998 and 2001, and he was the first person to be arrested for breaking the economic sanctions on Iraq for taking children's medicines to Iraq without an export license. Oh, what a horrible crime. I just don't know what to say about the... that's, you know... I mean, denying medicine to people is just really over the top. And so, without further ado, I'd like to introduce Milan Rye. And are you there?
Yes.
Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And I'm really glad that we can interview you today. I wish that we could have had you in person, of course, but you're not in Portland yet. Unfortunately, I never received the advance copy of your book for my perusal, so I'm going to be doing this interview on the fly, so to speak. I have read up as much as possible, on the Internet, but I wasn't able to read your book. It has not arrived yet, so you'll have to forgive me for my ignorance of its contents.
I'm very sorry that hasn't happened.
Well, we'll just have to go around it. So, as I said, welcome to the show, and I'm really glad that you have come to the U.S. to travel around and discuss your work in the U.K. I know people are vaguely aware, like many Americans, we have, tunnel vision and a slanted media, and we also have enough of our own problems that many people don't follow the events in other countries extremely closely. So if you could just detail for us briefly... highlight the events of 7-7 for those who are not super familiar with them, talk a little bit about why you decided to write this book. That would be great.
Well, last July there were 2 major bombing attempts by young groups of men who seem to have been inspired by Osama bin Laden's call to action. And one group detonated their bombs on the underground trains and on a bus on the 7th of July, and they killed themselves and 52 Londoners of a wide cross-section of Londoners. And another group of young men failed to detonate their bombs on the 21st of July, and there are now a group of men awaiting trial in Britain on charges related to the 21st of July attacks. Because that trial is still ongoing, I couldn't discuss it in that incident and what we know about some of those men, one of the people who's on trial fled to Rome and gave some very interesting interviews to the Italian newspapers, but I couldn't really cover that story because it's still sub judice and we're still waiting for the trial to resolve. So the four young men who carried out the 7/7 attacks, we know quite a lot about them. Three of them came from Leeds, from a kind of run-down suburb of Leeds, which is heavily South Asian, Pakistani origin community. And one of them was a guy who converted to Islam as a teenager. He didn't come from a Muslim background. And when you look into their backgrounds, all of these guys in their teenage years were basically outside of the orbit of their communities. They didn't want to have really anything to do with their parents and their community restrictions and Islam and so on. They weren't religious in any way. And something happened, and they started to identify more and more with themselves as Muslims and with a interpretation of Islam, which actually was very different. In fact, the polar opposite of the kind of Islam that they came from, their family backgrounds, in the case of the three Pakistani heritage men. And there are a number of factors that you can point to, but people who knew them well said that the key factor in their radicalization was when an Islamic bookshop started up in Beeston, in this suburb of Leeds, and it became a source of DVDs which showed Russian atrocities against Muslims in Chechnya, Israeli mistreatment of Palestinians, and so on and so forth. And that was when they really started to get into their identity as Muslims, to a certain interpretation of Islam, and they started to feel more and more connected to the call to action by Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network.
And so you feel that these young men were attempting to draw attention to the fact that the larger context of this, of course, is the Blair administration and their connections with, the Bush administration and the rationale, just to put it with heavy air quotes, for the Iraq War. And so I know that you were opposed to said war, as are many of us, and that many Britons are as well. So in your book, from what I can gather from reading up on it, it appears to me that you have really deconstructed the Blair administration's duplicity, shall we say, in the whole matter. And that the bombing is sort of like a loose thread that when you pull on it, it unravels some of the central arguments of the Blair arguments about why the UK is in Iraq in the first place.
I think that's absolutely right. One of the things that happened immediately after the 7/7 attacks was that there were a number of polls which found that a majority of people in Britain instinctively recognized that there was a connection between the Iraq war and the terrorist attacks in London.
Oh, I think that seems very reasonable assumption to me.
Sure. So a majority of people instinctively recognized that. And in fact, if you go back over the years, the majority of people in Britain, and I remember seeing polls from the US, the majority of people in Britain certainly knew beforehand that the invasion was likely to increase the risk of terrorism as a kind of form of revenge. And that was expected, though of course no one knew quite how bad the war was going to be, and therefore quite how much hatred it would engender. But instinctively people recognized that there was a connection. The Blair government has done its very best to poo-poo such an idea, but one of the reasons I wanted to write the book was that after the 7/7 attacks, an enormous amount of information came into the public domain through being leaked to the media, principally, which demonstrated irrefutably that internally the Blair government accepts completely that its own foreign policy is a major factor in increasing the risk of this kind of terrorism. So there was a secret Home Office, Foreign Office report with intelligence input from over a year earlier, which came into the public domain, which said foreign policy was a primary cause of increasing extremism, in quote marks, amongst young Muslims. There were reports from the intelligence services. There was a declassified document which showed that 5 weeks before the invasion of Iraq, British intelligence warned Tony Blair that invading Iraq would heighten the threat of terrorism from the Al-Qaeda networks. You know, a whole ton of stuff came out. But what happened with all of that information was that if it was noted in the papers at all, it subsided from view almost immediately, as though, I'm not saying this is what happened, as though someone had said, hey, we can't talk about that anymore. I don't think that's what happened at all. I think the reason why it subsided was it was a kind of internalized self-censorship in the newspapers. But regardless of the mechanism, the plain fact is that information which was crucially important to having a rational discussion about the problems that we're facing and that was absolutely necessary to judging the honesty with which the government was conducting its side of the debate was effectively suppressed. It kind of disappeared from view and has not formed part of the mainstream debate. So we know two things. We know that the government believes that foreign policy, its own foreign policy since 9/11, has increased the risk of this kind of terrorism. And we know that publicly, Tony Blair and his ministers have flatly denied this. And therefore, regardless of what you think about the judgment that the Iraq war is and British foreign policy in Afghanistan and so on is a major cause increasing the risk, it is undeniable that the government has been dishonest, because we know what they believe secretly and we know what they say publicly, and the two things are contradictory.
Well, I'm shocked and appalled. I mean, that would never happen here. Facetious, of course. I mean, you know, there a number of people here who are disgruntled with the Bush administration have not so kindly referred to Tony Blair as Bush's poodle, which is, you know, although it's a bit of an insult, I'm afraid it's not too far from the truth in terms of the blind willingness to agree with, to have complicity between our two countries in this matter. And everything that you've said, of course, is, you know, we're seeing it here as well. Do you think that have these bombings and the aftermath and the revelations about the Blair government has that radically diminished the support for Blair in the UK or not?
Just to say, I think the perception of Tony Blair as a poodle is very widespread across the political spectrum. I think in Britain. In terms of the impact of the bombings and the revelations, unfortunately what happened was that, as I say, immediately after the bombings, the polls showed that a majority of people in Britain, 64% according to one poll, 85% according to another poll, felt the connection with British foreign policy. But very soon after that, there was a major campaign by the government in which the media cooperated to channel people's anger about the bombings, basically against Muslims in Britain. It was channeled against radical preachers, which, you know, the British government has said a lot of very fine words about respect for Islam and so on and so forth. But when you point to radical preachers as the problem, you are basically stirring up fear of Muslims per se.
Yes.
So there was the you know, radical preachers were a problem. The solution was to deport these kinds of people to torture states where, you know, they could be dealt with properly. Then there was a big debate about multiculturalism and the failure of Muslims to integrate. So basically it was, you know, what the government did and the media colluded and a lot of left liberal people, including the head of the Commission for Racial Equality, joined in with placing the onus for this problem entirely on the Muslim community.
That's pretty appalling.
Yeah, it was appalling. And, you know, there was alongside that, and in fact, probably in the early stages of that campaign, there was a dramatic increase in anti-Muslim feeling in Britain. So the revelations have had almost no effect because of the way in which they've been effectively suppressed. The bombings have been channeled into support for repressive legislation and into hostility towards Muslims, I would say. So, unfortunately, the net effect of it all has been probably not too damaging to the Blair administration. Though, of course, because of the situation in Iraq, the Blair administration has lost a lot of support, and you know, Blair, like Bush, has been seeing his worst approval ratings since he came into power.
I mean, it's like as I said earlier, this is almost completely parallel with the sorts of things that have been happening here, as you no doubt are aware. And
sure.
It's many of us like to think. I mean, among the left community here in America, a lot of us get our real news from, you know, UK papers on the web, The Independent, The Guardian, you know, that's the only place we can find out what's really going on in the world. But yet, it's discouraging to hear that the UK has as deep a problem with this as the US does. I think that's a little bit disheartening, but, you know, still we must continue on. Well, I wanted to ask you, you know, you're involved in so many groups. You're involved in, you know, you're a founder of Arrow and Justice Not Vengeance, and you founded Voices in the Wilderness in the UK. And so, you know, you're very, this is obviously the focus of your work is peace and, you know, and a resolution of this issue about Iraq and, you know, preventing this sort of knee-jerk, blame of Muslims and other people. So, I mean, what do you see as the core of all this? I mean, if we can, assuming that we could end the war in Iraq, I don't think that in and of itself is going to solve the problem. I mean, it's a much more complex issue than that, obviously. What sort of things do you feel are crucial for people to know and to do to get out of this mess on a global level?
Well, I mean, obviously there are lots of different bits of the mess, but I think that one crucial bit of it is about how Western societies respond to the threat and challenge posed by the network of networks, which we call Al-Qaeda. And I think that that's a big issue, not just for people who are anti-war, but for people across a wide range of concerns, because the fear of Al-Qaeda is being used by governments across the West and further afield to mobilize popular support for all kinds of programs and initiatives and to reinforce conformism and reactionary attitudes. So the issue of Al-Qaeda actually touches on a lot of other issues as well, which, you know, at first sight don't seem to be related. And it relates to economic issues and all sorts of things, because when we appear to be under threat, our leaders find it easier to get us to go along with things which we don't really think are a very good idea. I think you're absolutely right that simply pulling out of Iraq, I don't know if one can use the adverb simply in relation to that, but simply pulling out of Iraq would not in and of itself mean that the Al-Qaeda insurgency would come to an end.
Yeah.
And, you know, we saw that in relation to Spain, where after Spain had a change of government and was withdrawing troops, there were a number of other groups who were inspired in a similar way to the Madrid bombers who continued to try to organize attacks. But that's because Afghanistan is just as important to that section of the jihadist movement as Iraq. And so, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan are two major problems in terms of creating hatred and anger. And obviously there is also the Israel-Palestine crisis. And then at a lesser level of intensity, there's Western support for or lack of positive representation towards things like Chechnya and Kashmir and so on. But I think if the Western powers took a just and legal and more restrained line in relation to Iraq, Afghanistan, and Palestine, if they got out of Iraq, if they got out of Afghanistan, and if they took a fair approach to the Israel-Palestine crisis, then a lot of this problem would be pretty much reduced to zero, a lot of it, not necessarily all of it, because what we can affect is not necessarily the behavior of Osama bin Laden and Ayman al-Zawahiri, but what we can affect is the willingness of people to give money and to volunteer and to organize the kinds of attacks that we've seen. And those people who are doing those things are highly motivated right now because they feel that their people are under a massive assault from the West. And if we stop carrying out a massive assault, then we will have much less motivation to do those kinds of things in those kinds of communities around the world.
Well, and I think it's an extremely complex issue, obviously. And I think that the interesting thing about I think that the whole demonization of Al-Qaeda as the ultimate enemy, and I don't know. It just seems like this is basically what you've started doing in this book with your subject matter is, as I said, unraveling a very complicated knot that only reveals more complications the more you pull on the string. I noticed that in the rundown of the table of contents of your book that you have a chapter. The concluding chapter is called Terrorism, Theirs and Ours. And I think this is something that many people have a hard time accepting, the fact that some of the things that the G8 powers, especially most notably the UK and the United States, have done and continue to do around the world that we call foreign policy or, some nice euphemism is really very, very little different from the terrorism that we pin on groups like Al Qaeda. That there's really, that's a difference in semantics. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
Well, I mean, we've got a really pressing case right now, which is in relation to Ramadi in Iraq. Now, the reason why people inside and outside Iraq hated Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is because he took hostages, who he brutalized and then killed. Now, what's happening in Ramadi is that the United States isn't taking a hostage. It's taking a whole city hostage.
Yes.
And it's brutalizing people there, and it's saying that very shortly there's going to be a significant loss of life there. And we know from Fallujah that a lot of that violence is going to be indiscriminate, and unless there's an enormous amount of protest, it's going to involve illegal, indiscriminate weapons. So we've got a case where, you know, you don't stop terrorism by acting like a terrorist.
Well, what obviously you do, not.
Yeah, what you do is you create more terrorists.
Exactly.
And that's what's going to happen in Ramadi unless there's an enormous amount of protest about it to check the preparations that are being made. But on a bigger historical scale, there shouldn't be any ambiguity about this because, as I'm sure everyone listening knows, the United States is the only government in the world that's been found guilty of international terrorism by the World Court mm-hmm. in relation to its sponsorship of the Contras and the mining of harbors in Nicaragua. When Nicaragua was under terrorist attack, it didn't start bombing the perpetrators. It took the legal route and went to the International Court of Justice and say, look, we've got a problem here. We've got some terrorist forces who are being funded from abroad and armed from abroad and directed from abroad attacking us, and we've got these mines in our harbors, and the International Court of Justice found the United States guilty of the unlawful use of force across international boundaries, which, if you translate from legalese, is international terrorism. So,
but we like to pretend that that's okay because we did it, you know.
Yeah.
Anything's okay that the U.S. does.
Absolutely.
If anybody else does it, it's not okay.
Absolutely. But, you know, it should just not be there shouldn't be any ambiguity about it, because we have a legal ruling by the highest legal body in the world that the United States government has been guilty of international terrorism.
Well, and I think that certainly if the behavior of the Bush administration over the last, you know, several years was to be examined by the world court, I suspect that they would also, there would be more war crimes laid at the feet of George W. Bush, and perhaps at Blair's feet as well. I'm, you know.
Oh, I'm sure that's the case. I'm sure that's the case. Now, interestingly, one of the things that Bin Laden uses to mobilize people is something which stretches back much further, back to 1991. Which is the economic sanctions on Iraq.
And I think that's really it's disgusting what we've done.
Yeah, and you know what he says to his audience is, you know, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children died of the economic sanctions because of the United States and Britain, basically, who kept that going year after year. There was not a flicker of interest in the West until very, very late in the game. As long as they feel no compunction about killing us, killing our children by the hundreds of thousands, then we should feel no compunction in reverse. Now, I don't accept that at all. But you've got to see that the reason why he's able to appeal to people and make them feel angry and hateful is because an enormous crime was done. And this obviously predates George W. Bush.
Well, and continues to be done, certainly.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know, there's many outrages going on currently in Iraq that, you know, that we have the power to correct, but we haven't been. And I wanted to mention that it is 3 minutes after 8 o'clock, and you are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. This is Positively Revolting Talk Radio. I'm Melody Silverwolf, and I've been joined by the lovely Chris Andre, whose microphone is not yet turned on, so she can't participate in the show. I suspect it's getting turned on right this minute. And our guest on the phone is Milan Rai, who is the author of 7-7, The London Bombings, Islam, and the Iraq War, along with a number of other works. Milan is currently touring the U.S. He's going to be visiting Laughing Horse Books this coming Wednesday. Laughing Horse has now moved to 12 Northeast 10th Avenue, just off Burnside. He's going to be appearing there at 7 o'clock discussing his book and related topics. And so Chris has been patiently waiting to say something. I believe your microphone works now. Yes, excellent.
Yes, I'm Chris Andre, and Melody has asked me to come in and offer a few questions. I've got a question, actually. On Democracy Now! Yesterday morning, there was an interview with a young British Muslim, a postman, I believe, postal worker, who police came, entered his apartment and shot him and tossed the place. They ransacked it. The guy was in the hospital very briefly, and then apparently was carted off to jail. It's been treated as, you know, just a, you know, a minor mistake by British authorities. I wondered if you would comment on the effect that has on the Muslim community in England.
Good question.
Well, I'm in Chicago, so I'm not in a great position to judge. But from what I'm gathering, the Muslim community is extremely shocked and worried that, from the perspective of a lot of people in Muslim communities in Britain, a young man has been shot for being Muslim and not myself.
Rather disturbing.
No charges were pressed. He was not guilty of anything at all. He was simply, you know, living his life. I believe his brother also. Brother wasn't shot, but
appalling.
Yeah, he was roughed up.
Well, and coupled especially with the decision of our Supreme Court yesterday that now allows the police to burst in with a warrant without knocking, I really feel that these two things, you know, taken together, do not exactly paint a very rosy picture of the rights of law-abiding citizens in either nation. I wanted to point out that this is a call-in show, and many of you listening no doubt have questions, comments. This is a pretty juicy topic, and if you have a question or comment for Milan Rai, if you'd like to be part of this conversation, all you have to do is pick up that phone. The number is 503 231-8187. So let's hear from those of you out there in the listening audience and hear what you have to say about all this. And Balan, I wanted to ask you further. I know that you are currently, as you make your way across the U.S. talking about your book, you're on a peace tour. Would you like to talk about that a little bit?
I've been speaking in various places and visiting with peace activists in a number of locations, and I also took part in the Voices for Creative Nonviolence Walk for Peace, which is going from Springfield, Illinois to Chicago, which I think is about 320 miles. So I took part in it for a couple of days, and it was a very wonderful and positive experience, and I was really surprised by how much of a positive response we have from the motorists who are driving along beside us.
Well, I think most Americans are really finally woken up to the realization that Iraq, going into Iraq and taking military action there was not the best idea. And I think they've figured out that it's a huge money sink and that it's only killing innocent civilians and and military personnel alike, and that it's not really helping anyone. And it took them a while, but at least they did finally realize this. And, especially in the particular cities that you were in, those are areas where people tend to be a little bit more liberal than some parts of the country. But I think it's really heartening that finally, people really do realize the error of this war, but that isn't the same thing as ending it, unfortunately. So,
I think there are two challenges. One is getting people to move from thinking that it was a mistake, which is John Kerry's position, which is a morally neutral category, mm-hmm. and it cost too much, basically, either to the Iraqis or to us. Getting them to move from that to recognizing that something morally wrong has happened, something against the law has happened.
Well, that's a whole other step that Americans are a little slow to take.
Well, and I think the other challenge is mobilizing people who feel that the occupation is wrong to actually doing something about it and exerting pressure, because it doesn't matter if we convert 100% of the people in Britain and the United States to thinking that it's wrong if they don't do anything about it, and it's only action that is actually going to be of benefit to the Iraqi people.
I'd like to just ask another question. You mentioned this peace march, and I believe you said from Springfield, Michigan, is that right?
Illinois.
Yeah. Is this going to pick up more participants, perhaps? Will you be going through, for example, I think Dearborn, Michigan? There's a huge Muslim population there. Will members of that community be joining you? And if not, would it be because of the sheer impact of the intimidation tactics and racial profiling that's been and so characteristic of this country's approach to the Muslim population?
Well, I'm not sure to what extent there has been outreach to Muslim communities either in Illinois or nearby, who might be able to take part in it. My only job was to join it for a few days rather than being in the organizing side of it. I think that the idea for Voices for Creative Nonviolence was to do something that would be in the kind of heartland of the United States, that would reach out to some people in that state, if not others, and to try and stir them to think again and to act more. And certainly that's what I saw as I was with the walk for a couple of days, that they were having a considerable impact on the local communities through the media and otherwise. And I completely agree with you that it would be wonderful to seek involvement from Muslim communities. I don't know to what extent that's happened, but I would say that it's a very positive experience, and if anyone is able to join the Voices for Creative Nonviolence Walk, then you can find out the details of the itinerary on their website. And I find it a very moving and positive experience.
Well, we do have a caller, so let's go ahead and talk to that person now. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi. Hello?
Yes,
hello,
you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? I'm just listening to this English guy going on and on and on about the English government and the American government. What about when England went to Ireland for years? They locked hundreds mm-hmm. and hundreds of people up.
Good point.
I think that's part and parcel of it.
With no charges, and the British citizens just sat back and let it go and blah, 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 because they didn't really care. Nobody really cared. They had the Secret Service going over there, the SAS, shooting people in the back of the head. This has gone on for years and years and years and years.
I agree.
And why would we, as a people, expect anything to change?
Well, that's a good question.
Why now all of a sudden should we expect the British people to care? British people don't care about anything as long as they're making money.
I don't know if that's a kind of a broad brush characterization. What do you have to say about that?
They care about football a lot.
All you got to do is, and I go to the football, I fly over to the football all the time, and all you got to do is erase the most racist people in Western Europe. Just go to the football games and listen to the chants.
During this World Cup, there have been incidents of racial violence, and I include verbal attacks in that category of racial violence.
Well, I think any time that you have the government, as Milan Rai said earlier, going to people's homes and arresting them simply for, apparently, for being who they are, that's got to have an effect on the gestalt of people's views of other nationalities, other religions. That's not a good effect. What do you have to say about that, Milan?
Well, I didn't catch everything that was just said, but I think that what was being said was that what is happening now in relation to Al-Qaeda and Muslims and so on is very familiar in terms of British oppression of the nationalist community in Northern Ireland and the Irish community inside Britain itself. And I think a lot of it is very familiar in terms of oppressive practice, mm-hmm. and in terms of repressive laws, and in terms of the mistreatment of innocent people. All of that's absolutely familiar. What's also familiar is the demonization.
Mm-hmm.
What's also familiar is the reversal of responsibility. And all of those kinds of things are absolutely true. The reason why I wanted to write this book was, as I was saying earlier, was that the issue of Al-Qaeda has been placed by our government at the core and at the center of public life and is being used to mobilize people for all sorts of terrible things in terms of civil rights, in terms of wars abroad, and so on and so forth. And therefore, anyone who cares about peace in the world, anyone who cares about civil liberties, anyone who cares about a whole host of issues which are affected by the way that our governments are manipulating this issue, has to try to provide to the vast bulk of the population a coherent explanation of what is going on, which puts together the available evidence to show that it is not simply a matter of opinion by some kind of left-wing peacenecks, but there are undeniable facts from leaked government documents and so on that demonstrate that the problem we have is to make our government stop committing crimes abroad, directly and indirectly. And when we do the right thing, we will do the safer thing. And that is the kind of message that we need to be able to put together in a clear, comprehensive, and evidence-based way to the vast bulk of people who are, at the moment, vulnerable to the calls from Bush and Blair that safety first means rights and freedoms and last.
Yes.
I have a quick question. To what would you attribute the apparent demise of diplomacy in not that distant past, I mean the 20th century, 19th century, nations relied on diplomacy, and though, arguably it might be considered a house of cards, nonetheless, there were treaties and agreements between countries, and although power did shift constantly, there were not these sort of violent cataclysmic events. It seems like just this week, unfortunately, they've been talking about diplomacy, but the word has been sort of bled of all meaning. And what we talk about diplomacy in the United States, anyway, talks about diplomacy. What they really mean is threats And I just wonder, we don't, is it that we have, you know, a dearth of intelligent people, of statesman-like people, or the leaders? I don't see actually any signs of diplomacy anymore. We've got...
It's so 20th century.
Well, we've got now this Trans-Sahara Counter-Terrorism Initiative. We're going to militarize North Africa.
Yikes.
Was in the news this morning. Can you comment on diplomacy?
Well, I have to say that, you know, if we look back at the 19th century and the record in diplomacy and the record in terms of catastrophes, I mean, we're speaking in the United States, and there was a lot of diplomacy in the United States between... there had been a lot of diplomacy, and what happened in the 18th and 19th centuries in terms of diplomacy and broken treaties, you know, we don't need to go through that. And internationally, always, international treaties and international laws have always been used by powerful states to constrain less powerful states, but they've always felt free to break those when it was in their interest. And so I don't think that, you know, when you go back and look at 18th, 19th century Europe and kinds of machinations that there were, I don't think you can necessarily say that diplomacy was in such great shape back then. But nowadays, for the United States and Britain, very, very often, they are diplomatically weak on in particular areas and on particular issues, but they're militarily strong. And so, you know, this isn't my observation, this is Noam Chomsky's observation, the United States and Britain have an interest in shifting conflicts to areas where they've got the advantage, which is to say to the military sphere. Now, for example, with Ramadi, which we've got right now, with Ramadi, the U.S. is launching a military solution to the problem of the enormous amount of al-Qaeda in Iraq activity in that city, which is destabilizing the whole place for everybody. Now, in the case of Fallujah, before the assault on Fallujah in November 2004, the insurgent organizations in Fallujah made an offer to the U.S. to say, we will give up our heavy weapons, we will get rid of the foreign fighters in Fallujah, in return, and we will allow Iraqi government police into Fallujah if you promise not to attack and if U.S. forces stay out. And there were various other elements to that offer as well. But that was, I don't think it was even dismissed. I think it was completely ignored by the U.S. And I am not sure if a negotiated solution is possible in Ramadi, which is a much more intractable problem possibly than Fallujah. But until it has been shown that a negotiated solution is impossible, you cannot start to talk about justifying an assault in Ramadi.
Exactly. Well, of course, you know, George Bush can do whatever he wants because he's the decider, don't you know?
Well, there's not even an attempt at a negotiated, I don't see any attempt whatsoever. I don't think they want that.
No.
I think they would like to construct the appearance,
yes,
of a negotiated solution being rejected by the other side. But I don't think that there's ever any intention at all. I mean, there was talk 2 weeks before the United States attacked Iraq. The Iraqis wanted to meet in Europe, I believe. They wanted to meet in Geneva with representatives of the United Nations and the United States and Britain and foreign powers.
And we refused.
And that was turned down flatly.
Well, we do have a couple of callers. Let me remind you the telephone number, 503-231-8187. We are interviewing Milan Rai, an activist from the UK who is currently touring the US, will be in Portland on Wednesday at Laughing Horse at 7. And he's the author of 7-7, The London Bombings, Islam, and the Iraq War. Let's talk to our next caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello. I'm curious about something. We had a thing where a female army specialist was arrested, who went AWOL, was arrested by the local police in Eugene, Oregon. And I'm curious, in your country, do the local police work for the military or arrest people that have deserted, whatever, from the military over there? Also, another thing I wanted to ask, is a lot of diplomacy done by computers? Anyway, thanks a lot.
Well, that's an interesting question. Do the police cooperate with the military in that way in the UK?
They do, yes. And, in fact, back in 1991, I was one of a group of supporters who were there when someone, a guy called Vic Williams, who had gone AWOL and who had spoken at anti-war demonstrations and so on and evaded capture. After the war was over, he handed himself into a local police station and then was going to be taken to the military police system. So, yes, they do cooperate. I didn't quite get the question about diplomacy.
I think she was asking if it's conducted by computer. I got the impression that diplomacy was generally conducted face-to-face, but I think...
Well, I guess it's conducted in a variety of ways, but I think that, generally speaking, the most important forms of diplomacy are done face-to-face, and you know, that is very relevant to the mm-hmm. situation with Iran, which I think was just referred to briefly there, where the Iranians have been willing for a long time to have face-to-face negotiations, and the U.S. launched an initiative a couple of weeks ago where they appeared to hold out the prospect of face-to-face negotiations finally after having refused it for months and months and months. But the precondition was one that they knew would almost certainly lead to an Iranian rejection of their offer, which was to say that the Iranians would have to stop enriching uranium, which is the thing that the Iranians are willing to negotiate about. So giving it up as the precondition
seems
the
rather unlikely.
So it was designed to be refused, basically.
Well, and of course, you know, we've been making, or Bush rather, has been making these horrific and frightening noises about using tactical nuclear weapons against Iran, which scares the whatever out of me and a lot of other Americans, as well it should. I mean, that just is appalling to me. But at any rate, we have a number of callers waiting to ask questions, so let's go to our next caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the power projectionists. And the power projectionists is the term that I use to talk about the top 1% who is running the United States and Great Britain through the stock market apparatus. And just what they're after, who they are, what they're after, and how they manipulate markets to get what they want. They're very detached people. They go to work and they trade stocks and they also, you know, order where new developments are going to be built and so forth. And it all accrues wealth onto them. They're the top 1% that came out of the property owning classes of England before the colonization of America. They orchestrated all of the global trade, the slave trade, the cotton trade, and they accrue wealth onto themselves. They see the bottom 90% as being nothing but workers who create wealth for them. And this power projectionist class came to the forefront in the United States post-World War II, and they didn't like the UN, they didn't like Roosevelt, they didn't like New Deal programs, they didn't like social democracy, they didn't like progressivism, which took decades and generations to create. They don't like regulated capitalism, which works. They're just purely out for blood, out for money, lazy, non-working, power accumulating murderers. And what we need to do is we need to show a people's solidarity. We need to let them know that we know who they are, we know how they operate, and we know what their goals are. And their goals are to destroy social democracy, which is a better form of capitalism than market manipulated capitalism. They're out to destroy progressivism, that is, making human lives better through government and non-government organization. And they're out to destroy regulated capitalism. Actually, there are many, many forms of capitalism. We're being foisted. They are foisting on us a very aggressive, wealth-concentrating form of capitalism. They do it through the control of property and so forth, collecting the rents and leases.
Did you have a question, Cor?
Well, I just want to say that I just would like to see the leftist movement quit looking at the people as being the blame and look at all of the manipulations of the top 1%. Can we focus our desire for change by way of disempowering the power projectionist.
I think that's basically what we're all talking here. I think that I suspect that's why Milan Rai wrote his book, was to point out that, you know, to demonize these individuals who supposedly did the bombings and or Muslims in general, or even to demonize Al-Qaeda as the cause of all our problems, is too narrow-sighted, that, you know, that we need to look at a much bigger picture, as you were discussing. I suspect
I want to address the whole audience out in radio land by saying that it seems like in the last 20 or 30 years, everything the right wing does accumulates wealth onto them. When they engage in militarism, they probably rig all of the contracts so that they accumulate a lot of money with which to manipulate the politics. When they make a lot of laws that put people in prison, like drug laws, then they accumulate power into the police forces.
Well, I think
and
we're
so
all
that
agreed
the
about
police,
this caller.
Police agencies are comprised of people who are right-wingers, people who like to carry a gun and put people in jail, and those people probably vote right-wing, and they probably... Mm-hmm. It takes money away from the general budget to operate a world system like this.
Well, I totally agree, and thanks for your comments. And we're going to go ahead and take another caller.
Wait,
because we have quite a few waiting.
I don't entirely agree. I think that we have to beware of generalizations.
Yes, very much.
And also, I think it's not, we fall into the same trap as many on the right do when we paint a picture of the world in black and white.
I agree.
I think it's a great deal more complicated than that.
I agree, although I do certainly agree that, you know, that pointing the finger at various individuals who really lack a great deal of power is probably not a very productive use of our time and energy, and I think that that's pretty much what the entirety of the left is working towards, is getting people to understand the complexity of these issues and the fact that those in power who are not really addressing them from a position of coming from a good motivation are the ones that we really need to deal with. Let's go to our next caller and talk to that person. You're on the air.
Me?
Yes, that's you.
Okay, my name is Paul. I'm just wondering, just a question, where is Cindy Sheehan?
What do you mean?
Is she incarcerated still, or is she free?
I don't believe so. I'm not aware of that.
No, she's not
incarcerated.
Okay. I think she had the most effective plan of all. We camp out at places where they can't hide from us, but it has to happen in numbers.
Where do you think people should camp out?
Oh, White House lawn.
Well, I do believe, Milan, did you not get arrested for attempting to stand in front of Downing Street and read a list of the Iraq dead?
That happened, yes, last October.
So obviously, what do you think would happen if thousands of Britons decided to camp out on the sidewalk in front of Downing Street and hold a vigil? Would they all be arrested?
The issue really turned around whether or not you had permission from the police. I'm sure the police would not give permission for that kind of an event. So, yes, we would have mass arrests, and that probably would have a considerable impact. But I'd like to go back to something I said earlier, which is that I think we are faced with a challenge of action, certainly, and for that includes, as part of it, probably civil disobedience of the kind which Kathy Kelly and others carried out in Springfield yesterday when they occupied the office to protest against the threatened assault on Ramadi. But we also face this educational challenge of getting people who currently think that the war was a mistake to educate them about what's been happening there, to get them to realize that it was morally wrong and that a crime has been committed.
And that it was a premeditated crime, that it was entered into with the full knowledge that there were no weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam Hussein was not linked to Al-Qaeda or to 9/11, that the whole thing was a fabrication that was entered into for more nefarious reasons. I think that, I don't know about in the UK, but I think in America that's going to be a long time coming still. I think most people have just begun to maybe open their minds to that reality.
Well,
I think it's very difficult for Americans to acknowledge such things.
I've certainly met people who firmly believe, and I don't know what the opinion polls are on this, but I guess it's a very large chunk of the population, a majority of the population perhaps, who believe that Saddam Hussein was behind 9/11, and therefore, you know, there's a justification there for what the United States is doing in Iraq right now. And I think that's a major educational challenge.
Yes.
And while I am completely While I completely believe in protests, in civil disobedience, and so on, and I take part in those and I organize those, I completely support all of that. I think we do have a major educational challenge, which, you know, you carry out by conversations, by leafleting, by public meetings, by film showings, and all sorts of other ways, by what you do with your workmates and so on. But that is a big thing which needs to be done,
yes.
which can be helped by protest, but is something that has to happen face-to-face, basically, with people around you.
Well, I know that there have been surveys done here that shows that people who are regular viewers of Fox News, for example, that 98% of them believe that Saddam Hussein was responsible for 9/11, which, of course, Fox News is basically nothing but a right-wing propaganda arm of the Bush administration and the neocons in general. So, you know, I think, you know, we have even a more of a difficulty with the media here in the U.S., as I said earlier, than you do in the U.K., with it being a mouthpiece of the government. And although many of the people who work in media are well aware of the truth, they are reluctant to say it on the air or in print for fear of losing their jobs, et cetera. So, yes, I do think we face an uphill battle that way. I wanted to remind everybody, it's about 8:32 here. We'll be here until 9 o'clock. We're interviewing Milan Rai, who is currently touring America. Will be coming here on Wednesday, the 21st, at 7 p.m. at Laughing Horse, and he is touring to discuss his new book, 7-7, The London Bombings, Islam, and the Iraq War. And our number here, 503-231-8187. I'm here with Chris Andre, and if you have a comment or question for Milan Rai, feel free to call and ask now. And so let's take our next caller. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I apologize. If this is, question has already been asked and discussed, I just tuned into the show, but it's for your guest in regards to 7-7. We know for a fact that on 7-7, a former employee of Scotland Yard working for a private company was responsible for conducting a drill of the exact same type of an attack that happened on the 7-7 subway. We also know that Haroon Aswad, the mastermind, admitted mastermind now, and that's not debatable, was a former, I believe, actually a current British MI6 agent.
Oh, my.
And I don't know if this has been discussed by your guest. If it is not, I'd like to hear his opinion on it, if he could elaborate on it.
Would you like to discuss that, Milan?
I didn't quite catch the name of the supposed mastermind. I think that the...
Haroon Aswad.
Haroon Aswad.
Aswat with an A, A-S-W-A-T,
mm-hmm.
Aswat.
Well, as far as I understand, the police and intelligence investigation, they have not been able to detect any external mastermind to the group who carried it out. The cell leader, the leader of that particular group of young men, was a guy called Mohammed Sadiq Khan, who is one of the three men from Leeds. And so I am not aware of any evidence that indicates, let alone demonstrates conclusively,
okay.
That
well,
any
sir, you might
individual
check
was
that out. I appreciate your
mastermind.
I appreciate your opinion on and listen to the show. But yeah, Fox News even carried a piece on this where they were interviewing former CIA intelligence officers, and it's pretty. It got picked up a bit by the mainstream, but it's been admitted, so it's well worth looking into.
Well, I just don't know what to say about. I mean,
okay,
you know, we were just mentioning Fox News is not a reliable source.
Okay, all I can tell
you
is
you,
that
I agree with you.
Okay, all I can tell you is that I've looked into this quite a lot, and I'm not aware of any indication, let alone conclusive evidence, that there is any particular external mastermind to the group. And secondly, on the issue of the kind of contingency exercise that was going on, which was reported on Channel 4 News and a couple of other outlets, which was, I'm sorry, this is in the Voices office over here.
Okay.
We love dogs. the contingency exercise that was happening on the day of the 7th of July was a paper-based exercise with people sitting around a table done for a commercial firm. I don't see any real relevance, because those kind of contingency plans for, you know, what do you do in the event of a terrorist attack are happening every day
right.
in cities
it's
like London.
It's not as though London hasn't experienced terrorist attacks
yeah,
in the past.
Yeah, you know,
so.
People are doing those kinds of exercises all the time, and I can't see any significance in this particular exercise happening at that particular time for a commercial company. If we knew that a week before a government agency had done it, and then that government agency had been involved in the first on the scene to
mm-hmm.
these locations, then maybe you could start saying, hey, there's something here.
That's what happened, considered similar to what happened in the bombing of Judy Berry, for example. That very same scenario took place.
But this is a completely different picture.
Yeah. Well, I wanted to ask you also, in researching this interview, and as I said, since I didn't receive your book, I was looking all through the references to you on the Internet, and I came across a discussion on a blog about the whole issue of the train times, which on the day 7/7, on the day of the bombings, they had these closed circuit TV pictures of the bombers and the getting on the train, and et cetera, et cetera. And there was a whole issue about the trains being delayed and the fact that many people were contending that they couldn't have the train they got on didn't arrive at the station in time for them to have set off the bombs in person, et cetera. They must have been planted, et cetera. What do you have to say to that?
Well, the three main people involved were from Leeds, and there was this other guy
mm-hmm.
who lived in another town, and they converged at Luton, which
mm-hmm.
is north of London, and they took a train from Luton to King's Cross.
Which apparently was delayed by some kind of a track problem, and it didn't arrive supposedly until after the bombing took place. It's
well, and so what we have is we have CCTV footage of them at Luton, we have CCTV footage of them in King's Cross, and then we have footage of them dispersing and going in different directions, and then they catch different trains. And then we have forensic evidence of their bodies, their four bodies, at the four different explosion sites.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I really don't understand the big fuss that people are making about the train times. Now, maybe they are correct that the particular train, which was first identified by the police as the one that they caught,
mm-hmm.
maybe they didn't catch that train. Maybe they caught the earlier train. I just don't see that it's a major issue whether they caught the 748 or the 721. The fact is that their bodies were recovered from the explosion sites. So unless they were teleported to those locations, or there is some massive conspiracy involving all the people who carried out forensic reclamation, I just don't see what the big deal is about these train times, because we have footage of them at Luton. We have footage of them in London. We have their bodies being recovered from the locations where the bombs went off.
I guess the allegation was that somebody else planted the bombs and they were
well,
just innocent
yeah,
bystanders.
I mean, that I can see that if there is any evidence that someone else planted those bombs and then somehow got those four men to be in those four locations, then there would be something to discuss. But so far, no
mm-hmm.
one has come up with a shred of evidence that anyone except those four men set off those four bombs, and until that happens, I just don't see that there's anything really to discuss about that.
Well, I think that, you know, an awful lot of time on the left in this country gets spent on such diversions, and you know, although it might be interesting, I'm not so sure it really furthers anything. Well, let's go ahead and talk to our next caller. If you'd like to be a caller, you can still do so, 503-231-8187. And caller, you are now on the air.
Would that be me?
That's you.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I was watching a show. I just wondered if, I'm sure it didn't have any credibility, but there was an Iraqi official that had said that there were weapons of mass destruction as far as chemical weapons and such, and they were moved to Syria.
Well, that's not what Hans Blix said, and he should know, but, you know.
Well, this is an Iraqi official that was under Saddam Hussein and his army. Like a commander or something like that. I'm not exactly sure how credible the story was. I just wondered if you knew anything about that.
Do you have any comment on that?
Me? I'm afraid I didn't hear anything.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sometimes it's hard for the phone guest to hear the caller. He was saying that, commenting on the fact that there were no weapons of mass destruction, he said he saw an interview recently with an Iraqi official who had been an official under Saddam Hussein, who said that there were weapons of mass destruction and they were moved to Syria. That was
Obviously that's a possibility. However, again, there doesn't seem to be a shred of documentary or physical evidence that there were.
As I said, Hans Blix says there weren't, and he was there. So,
well, I'd just like to add to that Saddam Hussein, this is almost tragicomic, wanted very much to give the world the impression that they had weapons of mass destruction of one sort or another. It's pretty much certain that as far as, like, you know, artillery, there wasn't much left after the first Iraq, the first Gulf War, and then sanctions and so forth. But I think that he probably did, in fact, want to give the impression that they presented, you know, danger to the rest of the world, and many of his generals, his supporters, and so forth, the military.
That seems to be the issue of.
Well, again, all I'll reiterate is that there is no.
But if there were, even if there were.
Hang on a second, caller. I don't think that our guest can hear you. So you guys are talking over each other. Can you finish, Milan, and then we'll let the phone caller repeat his comment.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, all I was going to say was that the thing is, you know, the U.S. government has been over Iraq with a fine tooth comb, looking for any documentary or any physical evidence that Iraq had either weapons of mass destruction, the capability to make weapons of mass destruction, raw materials which could be used to make weapons of mass destruction, and they came up with a blank. And if there had been anything or any movement that could be detected, then we would know about it. So, you know, you can make any allegations, but so far the documentary evidence just isn't there to support those allegations, as far as I understand it.
Okay, caller, now...
It sure would give them a good excuse to go into Syria, though, wouldn't it?
Well, and of course, I do believe that the Bush administration may be looking for an excuse to go into Syria, although now it looks more likely that Iran is going to be the next target.
Right.
Well, thanks a lot for your call.
Thank you.
Take care. Before we go ahead and take our next caller, I wanted to let you all know what's going to be coming up at 9. It's about 8:42 right now, and at 9... we'll be all done. It'll be time for the Radio Zine. It'll be a focus on queer pride, beginning with our annual broadcast of the classic 1989 documentary Remembering Stonewall. The 1969 Stonewall Riot, of course, sparked the gay liberation movement in the U.S. At 9:30, we'll hear about the new Men's Wellness Center, which is part of the Cascade AIDS Project. We'll also hear from a local filmmaker and her film Monkey Rider. DJ Puppet will be in to talk about a national drag competition happening in Portland. I suspect that's drag as in drag queen, not drag racing. That would be interesting. Have drag queen.
That would be
drag racing. I like it. You can have double drag. There you go. And at 10:30, the guest is Alison Bechdel, comic artist of Dykes to Watch Out For. She's the author of a new graphic memoir called Fun Home. At 11 on Democracy Now!, you'll hear an attorney from the Center for Constitutional Rights on a federal judge's ruling that the government can legally detain non-citizens on the sole basis of their religion, race, or national origin indefinitely. Isn't that lovely? And a debate on whether doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists should participate in military interrogations. My God, I feel like I'm reading a script from Nazi Germany sometimes.
Yeah.
It's appalling.
It would seem so.
Okay, well, enough of that. Now let's go on with our next caller. And so, caller, you're on the air.
Hello?
Oh,
hi.
That's you.
I just want to make a comment on this allegation that Saddam's weapons of mass destruction were sent to Syria or Mars or Zeta Reticuli or wherever the conspiracy theory is.
Alpha Centauri.
I'm not going to put it beyond the realm of possibility. It's certainly possible, but one has to remember that the United States Air Force and the British Royal Air Force were overflying something like 75% of Iraqi territory for 10 years prior to the invasion. Now, that combined with the electronic surveillance from AWACS and other technological toys that I probably am not aware of, makes me very skeptical that Saddam could have gone to the washroom without the Brits or the Americans knowing about it. So
yeah, I'm sort of tending to agree with you there.
Yeah, people keep forgetting how much surveillance that whole country was under prior to the invasion.
And we do have satellites that are able to read license plates from space. So I find it hard to believe that they couldn't detect a weapons facility if they were looking, which I think is a really good point. Did you want to comment on that, Milan?
I don't think I have anything to add.
Well, I think he pretty much summed it up. Thanks a lot for your point, caller.
Thank you.
503-231-8187. We've got about 15 minutes left, and you can still be part of this conversation if you give us a call. Chris wants to say something.
There was the one, unless I missed it, is coming in late as I did. Nothing. We haven't discussed the role of Israel in the Middle East.
Not really, no.
We had a news story this morning. Iran and Syria have signed a mutual defense agreement because these two countries are very, very concerned about the nuclear threat that Israel does, in fact, present. I think one could make an argument that a great deal of the tension and the problems in the Middle East are caused by the fact that Israel is armed and dangerous.
Well, yes, one could, and I certainly would agree with it if you made that argument.
Mr. Raji, do you have a comment on that?
I think there's two just fundamental points, which is that as long as the Palestinians are suffering a visible injustice and are able to appeal to the Arab populations of the surrounding countries, there is a source of tension which is inflaming the whole region. That's just a fact. And the other thing, which is just a plain fact, is that Israel at the moment enjoys a nuclear monopoly in the Middle East. Now, we are causing, Britain, the United States, and a couple of other EU countries, we are causing an international crisis over the fact that Iran may, in 10 years or so, be in a position to break that nuclear monopoly. But we have never caused any kind of a confrontation over the fact that Israel acquired this nuclear monopoly with the assistance of the West. And until we are making serious moves to build a Middle East free from all weapons of mass destruction, then we're not really going to resolve the question of proliferation in the Middle East. And that must include all of Israel's weapons of mass destruction, as well as weapons of mass destruction held by other countries in the Middle East.
Well, of course. I mean, you can't have unilateral disarmament. Of course, Hans Blix has recently called for, an elimination of nuclear weapons, which I, of course, am all in favor of. I'm appalled that in the last 20 years ago, I was an anti-nuclear activist, as many of people were here in the U.S., in the U.K., and around the world, and it sort of seems to have been taken off the table for discussion.
Well,
nuclear weapons are good. Since when,
Absolutely. In Noam Chomsky's latest two books, he's been very strongly saying the two major threats to human survival, at least human survival at a level that we would consider a decent level of civilization. The two major threats are climate change and what's happening with the nuclear arms race right now, the militarization of space, and the new kinds of weapons which are being developed. I think that the problems that we're facing in relation to nuclear weapons are extremely grave. They are exciting almost very limited popular opposition compared to 20 years ago. But they are very, very grave in terms of weapons being put into space which are designed to be able to control countries and neutralize people and assets all around the world remotely from outer space. So I think that's a very major issue.
And you know that the United States we have a little competition going on here. Los Alamos and the Lawrence Livermore laboratories are competing with each other now to see who can be the first to develop a whole new generation of nuclear warheads. So they, rather than attempting to negotiate, a complete dismantling of these programs, here we are amping it up and challenging other countries to do the same, and there is an absolute thundering silence from the media on this.
Because they're too busy covering the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. Oh, dear. Well, I wanted to remind everyone, in case you've just tuned in, we have been discussing Milan Rai's new book, 7-7, The London Bombings, Islam, and the Iraq War. Milan will be here in town on Wednesday, the 21st, at Laughing Horse Books at 7 o'clock. Laughing Horse's new location is 12 Northeast 10th Avenue. It's just off of Burnside, just a few doors north of Burnside, and Milan will be there discussing his book and his work in general. Milan, I wanted to ask you, we often have people and discussions on this show about, the dire consequences of our actions and the rather appalling things that are going on in our world today. But we try to focus a little bit on what, now that we've freaked out our listeners, they're all appalled as well. They should be. What kind of solutions do you think people should be working? How do people address this issue? Where do we start to unravel this mess?
Well, there are a number of problems kind of wrapped up in what we've been talking about. One of the problems is to do with Islamophobia and the increasing levels of fear and hatred towards mm-hmm. Muslims. Now, myself, I'm not a Muslim. I come from a Hindu background. But I think that's a major problem in US society and British society, in Western societies generally. And I think there's a lot of very simple, positive things that anyone can do in terms of challenging Islamophobia in the media, in terms of reaching out to mosques and other Islamic institutions in your community and so on, in terms of standing up for Muslims who are under threat from repressive laws and things like that. So I think that's one strand of things. I think the central point that I was trying to make earlier was that there's a whole bunch of people out there who are very frightened, who place the safety of their families, their neighborhoods, their communities, their nation ahead of every other value, mm-hmm. and who are therefore vulnerable to the argument which Bush and Blair are putting forward, that we have to rip up all of our rights and we have to engage in foreign wars in order to be safe. And for those people, there is an educational effort that is required, and the reason why I wrote this book was to try and put together useful information in waging that educational effort to educate those people about why this threat has increased, how we can try to decrease it, and how it is connected to what our nations are doing abroad.
But one thing that worries me here is that fear has been, I think it's been clinically demonstrated to short-circuit an individual's ability to learn or to absorb new information or integrate new information into their belief system. So I have great concern. I think that the genius of the right in Britain and in this country is that they've marketed fear and terror. They've marketed it so well. They've done an excellent job of selling it, and people have bought it in mass quantities.
I agree completely, and that's why you need not opinions, but irrefutable kind of nuggets mm-hmm. and facts to
yes.
hand people. And so, for example, one very important nugget, I think, for those kinds of people who, as you say, are just consumed by the fear is, there's a guy called Michael Scheuer, who used to work for the CIA until last November, who ran the CIA's Bin Laden unit from 1996 to 1999. He is, therefore, one of Western intelligence's top Osama Bin Laden experts. And what he says is, and I think this is a very useful thing to give to people to try and shake them up, is that when President Bush says they attack us because of our democracy, because of our freedom, and so on, Michael Scheuer, CIA man for over a decade, says, that's rubbish. The reason why Bin Laden is attacking us and the way he manages to mobilize so many people to support him and to fund him and to volunteer for his brutal attacks is because he focuses on our policies abroad. And Michael Scheuer was asked point blank in a Buzz Flash interview last year, if we changed our policy on Israel, would that make a difference in terms of the level of threat we face? And he said, probably yes. Now, Michael Scheuer is a right-winger. He's a CIA guy. If this stuff could be solved by military means, he would be all mm-hmm. for it. And I think that kind of testimony from someone who comes from the heart of the CIA, who is a Bin Laden expert within the establishment, who says this is the result of what we are doing and we need to think again about what we are doing, especially in the Middle East. That is something that you can hand to someone who's very frightened and say, you're very frightened about your family and your neighborhood. If you want to protect it, listen to this guy, and then we've got to talk about what we're doing in the rest of the world.
But what was about the problem of the so-called trouble in the Middle East is an accident. It's a wonderful way of controlling resources, because as long as you've got chaos in a nation, it's easier to I think their intention was that it would make it much easier to exploit natural resources. So I don't think they're trying to solve the problem. In fact, they're trying to make it worse, because that works well for yeah. their long-term goal.
To play out the project
strategy.
For New American Century kind of things, yeah.
I'm not trying to say that anyone in government is trying to solve any problems. What I'm trying to say is when we are talking to the people who are very frightened, as you said, what can we say to them that they will actually hear for precisely the reasons that you said?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we need irrefutable things like CIA testimony, like leaked intelligence documents, like leaked documents from the heart of government, which, you know, are the kinds of things that I've tried to put together in my book, that are things that you can hand to someone who's very frightened, and you can say to them, here is something from government, from the CIA, about the real nature of this problem, and it contradicts
what you think,
what you think and what the government and the media are saying, and therefore we need to think again.
Okay, well, let's take a really super quick last call, and then we'll wrap this up. Caller, you're on the air.
Well, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, LJ. I'm good.
Okay, just a couple of quick things. First of all, let us not forget who funded Osama to begin with.
Yes, thank you.
And that would be the CIA.
That's right.
All right.
And who funded Saddam Hussein?
Right.
That would be us.
Okay. Number two, Israel has over 300 nuclear warheads. And considering that Israel is part of the Middle East, and we're insisting on no weapons of mass destruction in the Middle East, when did Israel not become part of the Middle East?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay,
bye-bye.
Great questions. And so, Milan, I want to remind people one more time that you're going to be here on Wednesday the 21st at 7 p.m. at Laughing Horse Books. And So we've just got a few minutes left. What would you like to say in conclusion to our audience?
Well, I'll just say what I was trying to say earlier, which was that we have a chance to present a coherent explanation, I think, to people about the crisis which is gripping our nations and which is frightening people so much. And I think we have a real chance to convince people that when we do the just thing, when we do, when we make foreign policy in accord with international law, when we have a fairer stance towards all peoples in the world, when we do the just thing, we do the safer thing.
I can't disagree at all. And Chris, did you want to make a comment on that?
No, I think that's entirely appropriate and, in fact, heartening to hear that. Yes, certainly would.
And so one thing I wanted to ask you in conclusion, Milan, is I just was announcing earlier that a federal judge has ruled that it's okay for the U.S. government to detain someone indefinitely if they're not a citizen based strictly on their race or nationality. Do you see that sort of thing happening in Britain at all? Because that's very disturbing to me.
It just did happen.
Well, I know, but is that a government policy that is present or coming, do you think?
Well, we have this we had this extension of the amount of time that the police can detain someone without charging them. Which the government was trying for 90 days, and the compromise was it was extended to 28 days. So you can be locked up now in Britain on suspicion for a month, and at the end of it, they can just let you go and say, we have nothing to say about this. We're not telling you why we locked you up, what you were supposed to have done that excited our suspicion and gave us basically the right to lock you up for an effective 2-month sentence because you get 50% off for good behavior. So I think that is a terrible erosion of freedom, and it is going to be used in a discriminatory way. It's going to increase fear and hatred. It's going to increase the support base precisely for terrorism. It's going to undermine national security.
Well, I can't disagree with that, and obviously this is, not just an American problem or a British problem. It's a global problem that we all need to work together. Do you have any final thoughts on how activists from, across the globe can work more effectively together?
Well, I think there are plenty of things that we can do to be more effective, but I think the starting point is we need to be in groups. We need to be in networks. That's the starting point, because you can't do things effectively on your own.
That's right.
And then groups can network, and national networks can relate to other national networks. But the starting point has got to be in a group with other people.
Yes.
And to work with the people who you work with and the people around where you live.
Well, we're
and
out
that's
of
where that's where you can have an effect.
We're out of time. That's a perfect conclusion. And thank you so much for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chris. And everybody, keep on being positively revolting.
Thank you both.
Stay tuned.
And you've been listening to Positively Revolting Talk Radio on KBOO. It's 9 a.m. Coming up this morning on the Friday Radio Zine. At 9, it's a focus on queer pride, beginning with our annual broadcast of the classic 1989 documentary, Remembering Stonewall. The 1969 Stonewall riots sparked the gay liberation movement in the U.S. At 9:30, we'll hear about the new Men's Wellness Center, which is part of the Cascade AIDS Project. We'll also hear from a local filmmaker about her film Monkey Rider. DJ Puppet will be in to talk about a national drag competition happening in Portland. And at 10:30, the guest is Allison Bechtel, comic artist of Dykes to Watch Out For and author of a new graphic memoir called Fun Home. At 11, it's Democracy Now! We'll hear from an attorney from the Center for Constitutional Rights on federal judges' ruling that the government can legally detain non-citizens on the sole basis of their religion, race, or national origin indefinitely, and a debate on whether doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists should participate in military interrogations.